So is a video avatar a true representation of real people, as Madden NFL fans and litigants seem to accept? Or is it something less? Surely James Cameron's characters from the film Avatar accommodated the most willing suspension of disbelief. But maybe that's because Na'vi and Cameron's other 3D aliens were rendered as aliens, not as human beings. Thus, he avoided the dangerous chasm into which many computer-driven movies fall, never to recover. It's a fear-inducing phenomenon called the Uncanny Valley. On the Media's Jamie York explains.
In 2001, DreamWorks was paying approximately $60 million for an animated movie about a green ogre named Shrek. And the animation brain trust, tasked with making this $60 million investment pay dividends, was well on their way. Lovable, if grotesque, green ogre? Check. Donkey sidekick that cracks wise? Check. Fantastic world for everyone to inhabit? Check. There was just one problem. In test screenings, the heroine, princess, and motivating force behind the movie was having a most unexpected effect.
They were so good at doing what they were doing with the princess character that when they showed it to audiences of children, the children started crying and freaking out because there was something wrong.
That's Lawrence Weschler, a longtime journalist who wrote about this incident for Wired magazine. It's true, the animators of Shrek were so good, so sophisticated, that they were scaring their intended audience. Why? Their princess had fallen into what's known as the Uncanny Valley.
Which was this notion by a Japanese roboticist named Masahiro Mori. The notion was that if you made a robot that was 50% lifelike, that was fantastic. If you made a robot that was 90% lifelike, that was fantastic. If you made it 95% lifelike, that was the best. That was so great. If you made it 96% lifelike, it was a disaster. And the reason essentially is because a 95% lifelike robot is a robot that's incredibly lifelike. A 96% lifelike robot is a human being with something wrong.
Mori called it the Uncanny Valley, a play on Sigmund Freud's idea of the uncanny, something familiar and yet foreign at the same time. Science and technology writer Clive Thompson.
More or less around the early 2000s, you started to get computer graphics inside games good enough that the people looked very people-like, and they were hitting that valley point. Because you would look at them and you go, oh, wow, that looks really realistic. And you get up close and you'd see the face and you'd realize that the skin wasn't quite moving the way it's supposed to move. And the eyes look sort of fish-like. And it was just, ah! You know, I would just shriek and shriek like a little girl because this face looked so horrifyingly dead and dull.
A computer-generated character climbs out of the valley when it finally looks and acts real. Create a character like Homer Simpson, and you're fine. A character like Tomb Raider's Lara Croft is a little unnatural, but so be it. The animated character based on Tom Hanks in The Polar Express, seriously creepy. The makers of Shrek, having learned their lesson, reimagined Princess Fiona as a slightly more cartoony-looking love interest, thus avoiding the valley. But Final Fantasy, a $135 million digital adventure which opened the same year as Shrek, fell into the valley and bombed. The studio that made it later folded. Similarly, Polar Express and Beowulf the movie left audiences unnerved by characters with dead eyes. On the other hand, Avatar...
Looks like you. This is your Avatar.
...uses awe-inspiring technology but avoids the uncanny valley because the aliens are distinctly alien. Blue, stretched, and unreal. The faces of the Na'vi don't trigger our uncanny reflexes because they're simply not human. Faces, despite 10 years of refinement in computer rendering, they're still the holy grail. So many muscles attached to each other, moving in tandem. So many complex and inimitable plays of light.
With faces, and especially with the whites of eyes, light behaves in a quantum fashion, exactly the way it does in milk. So that if you want to create a digital glass of milk and have a digital light go around it, unless you use quantum physics, you're going to end up with something that looks like chalk.
So much so, the animators practice first with bowls of digital milk. Weschler says that's because just a glimmer of inauthentic light in the eyes is enough to sink a project. Pixar, a company born of digital animation, which featured a rather unintentionally frozen-looking baby in one of its first short films. Pixar learned it wasn't worth the risk. And it's no coincidence that they've built their fortunes making protagonists out of those things that are easiest to light. shiny toys, cars, bugs, monsters, robots, an old man with square heads who loved balloons.
Are you in need of any assistance today, sir?
No.
Well, I gotta help you cross something.
No, I'm doing fine.
What's insurmountable in films is doubly so in video games, where the rendering has to happen on a second-by-second basis. Carmack Dorman is a professor of computer-human interaction at the Indiana University Department of Informatics. Intent on bridging the valley, he's been testing what precisely we feel when we look at near humans on the screen.
Out of perhaps, 28 different emotions, there are about 5 key emotions that are highly predictive of uncanny reaction. And the most important one is fear.
There are a number of theories as to why we fear when we gaze into the uncanny valley. One suggestion is that it's existential, because we see the potential for being replaced by nearly perfect computers. I don't quite buy that. Theologians argue that we're seeing human imitators that lack a soul. For me, the most convincing explanation for the fear is evolutionary. We see in uncanny faces something not quite right, something unhealthy or unappealing, and our instinct is to recoil. Maybe they're contagious. Maybe they're not suitable mates. Asif Ghazanfar is a professor in the Neuroscience Institute in the psychology department at Princeton University. He'd heard of the dread engendered by the uncanny valley, so he sought to test the reaction with his evolutionary indicator of choice, macaque monkeys.
Of course, we can't test extinct ancestors, so the only way you can test an evolutionary hypothesis in psychology or neuroscience or in any field is to do a comparative study where you test a closely related species.
Ghazanfar created for his subjects 3 different kinds of what he calls synthetic monkey faces, one unrealistic, one realistic, and one real. He flashed these faces on a screen for his 5 monkey subjects to watch in random order for 2 seconds each, and he tracked where their eyes went.
I mean, there's good reasons to think that they increased their looking times to things that they prefer. All 5 monkeys, as actually really remarkable, all 5 monkeys showed exactly the same pattern. When they look at the one that we predict would elicit the uncanny valley response, they looked at those images the least amount of time, which is also seems consistent with the interpretation that we're actually seeing a real uncanny valley effect.
Ghazanfar's research seems to suggest that the valley is real and the response is evolutionary, but we still don't know why. Ed Ulbrich knows the uncanny valley as only an explorer could. He was approached in the mid-90s to create the technology for the curious case of Benjamin Button. He concluded that it was impossible, and he declined. But in 2002, he reconsidered, and with his fellow animators, built the most sophisticated human likeness yet to appear on film. In the first 50 minutes of the film, we see a purely digital version of Brad Pitt's face, aging backwards. Ulbrich says that portion of the film plants a flag squarely on the other side of the valley.
To see the first motion of Benjamin now, a digital character, that carried all the subtleties of Brad's performance, it was a giant relief, and it was kind of celebratory. It's like, okay, we've done it. We're here.
But Lawrence Weschler and Clive Thompson argue that Ulbrich didn't scale the deepest part of the valley. Old wrinkled skin reacts to light differently and is easier to digitally render. And the conceit of a human aging backwards is inherently unreal, a fantasy. So we're more likely to forgive the uncanny effect. They're waiting for a romantic comedy where the lead is, oh, by the way, a digital creation.
Do a CGI version of, a well-known star like Gwyneth Paltrow in a way that I cannot tell it's not her and I'm not freaked out by it. When you've got that, I'll accept that you've crossed the valley, but not before then.
Clive Thompson says that when it comes to his beloved video games, he'd rather they give up than subject him to any more freaky zombie-like characters. He believes that if game designers would only ease off the obsession with realism, they could find true art.
I think that the pursuit of realism is horribly limiting for video games, and here's why. Think back to, the great age of deep realism in painting, and it sort of reached a point where, if you want to do a realistic painting of a road, there are only so many ways for that road to look, because, frankly, there are only a few ways that roads are different in the real world. Whereas when you get the Impressionists and the Cubists and that reaction, they're saying, there are 1,000 ways we can paint a road or a human face, right? Because we're trying to get at something that is deeper than just what it looks like. And suddenly art, in my view, became much more interesting and much more expressive.
For Lawrence Weschler, really bridging the gap between real and virtual comes down to something more ineffable than the algorithm for Newtonian light refraction or the blush on a cheek. For him, the eyes are important not simply because they're a problem to be solved, but because they have something more to tell us about what crossing the valley would really represent.
Sartre has this beautiful essay called The Face. He writes, "If I watch his eyes, I see that they are not fastened in his head, serene like agate marbles. They are being created at each moment by what they look at. If we call transcendence the ability of the mind to pass beyond itself and all other things as well, to escape from itself that it may lose itself elsewhere, then to be a visible transcendence is the meaning of a face." It's a great notion, the notion that what we face when we face a face is the future in some sense. It's omnivorous with intent and with expectation and with desire and with fear in a way that a thigh is not, which is why animating it becomes so much more complicated and so much more exciting.
That future, of course, isn't so far away. Scientist Asif Ghazanfar of Princeton envisions the creation of a digital human face that can help treat autism. Carl McDorman at Indiana University foresees a day when robots are companions for the elderly. And both are sure that time is coming, carried on a technological wave funded by Hollywood. But they are also sure that success will raise even more existential questions. McDorman imagines the moment when an old woman first realizes that her beloved companion is synthetic and doesn't really understand her. That's an uncanny shudder of a different kind, the kind we have when we stare in the face of what it means to be human. For On the Media, I'm Jamie York.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.